These students are here with the Courts and the State Bar's program entitled Court with Class. And this program has won 2 national awards, and we've been very pleased with it, and we're pleased to welcome you. The students have received synopses of the cases that they are about to hear and may have even discussed it. And these two classes will join with Heritage Christian of Milwaukee and Ron Colley High School of Manitowoc at noon, and we'll meet with Justice Prosser to discuss the practices and procedures of the court. Anyone else who would like to stay for that session, you are all cordially invited. Now that we have met you, I would like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated next to him is Justice John Wilcox, and to my immediate right, Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. To his left, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And at the far left of the table is Justice Prosser, with whom you will discuss the court. With those introductions made, I will call the second case today, which is Jones versus State of Wisconsin, number 97-3306, and representing Mr. Jones is Colleen Ball, and you may proceed to the podium.
May it please the court, my name is Colleen Ball and I represent Leonard Jones. With me at council table is attorney Beth Hannon. We are both from the law firm Reinhart, Berner, Van Duren, Norris, and Wieselbach. The court has posed 2 questions for review today, and I will give the short and direct answer to each question before I elaborate on some of the more key aspects of this appeal. Issue number 1, if property is seized pursuant to a search that leads to a charge of violation of Chapter 961, the Uniform Controlled Substances Act, must the state use the forfeiture procedures within that act, or can it proceed under Section 968.20? The state must use the forfeiture procedures within Chapter 961 for 3 reasons. First, a plain reading of Section 961.55 dictates this result. Section 961.55 sub 3 says, to summarize, that if the state seizes property that it believes is connected with drug trafficking, it must initiate prompt forfeiture proceedings under Section 961.555. Second, Section 968.20 is not a forfeiture statute. It's a general return of property statute. There was no Section 968.20 motion pending when the trial court ordered Jones's $1,800 forfeited under that statute. The trial court made a procedural error. Third, the legislature placed hearing and timing requirements in the forfeiture statutes to protect the property owner's rights to due process. If we allow the state to proceed under Section 968.20, then it can achieve forfeiture without going through the forfeiture procedures, and it negates those procedural safeguards. The second issue for review is if the state can proceed under Section 968.20, is cash considered contraband under Section 968.13, particularly when the charge arising from the seized property has been dropped? Again, the answer has 3 parts. First, cash can never be contraband.
Right, what's that?
Cash can never be contraband.
Just speak up.
Yes, I will. The framework of Section 968.13 and the Voschart Court's definition of the term contraband indicate that the term means something that is inherently illegal to possess. It does not extend to innocent items of property that may be put to an illegal use. Second, the broad definition of contraband urged by the state leads to absurd results, and it causes overlap among the statutes. I will get into some examples of that in a few minutes. And third, the Voschart Court held, and this is addressing the dismissal of the charges, the Voschart Court held that the state can confiscate contraband even if it has dismissed its case against the defendant.
Could you repeat that third point, please?
Yes, the third point is that this concerns the dismissal of the charges. The Beauchart court held that it doesn't matter whether the charges were dismissed. The state can seize property as contraband or retain property as contraband regardless of whether or not charges are dismissed.
I'm sorry, the state can retain? You'll have to slow down for me. I think my ears as I get older are just getting worse.
The state can retain contraband regardless of whether or not it has dismissed its case against the defendant.
But that makes sense because it's illegal material.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So isn't that contrary to the position? In other words, assuming that there doesn't have to be a finding, your position would be that cash is never contraband, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. And what is your support for that? Cash is never contraband.
There is not a Wisconsin case that makes that point, but our support for it is the Beauchart Court's definition of the term contraband, and in it, it says repeatedly that contraband is something that is inherently illegal to possess. We all possess cash. It's legal to do so. We don't need the authority from the state in order to have it.
But doesn't that kind of defy common sense that in some instances where similar to this, but I won't say directly on point for this case, that this court would come down with a ruling that cash can never be contraband?
I'm not sure I
understand. No, well, you're saying that cash is never contraband, and I'm just trying to say, conjure up some particular fact situation other than this, but it just seems to me to defy common sense that cash would never be contraband simply because it's a currency and it is not something that is used directly within the crime, even though as in this case you have a finding by a judge, albeit under the 968-21, but he associated that cash with the various other items used in drug dealing, the pads, the crack pipe, etc. So I'm just having a little trouble with just saying it never.
I think that is consistent here, and I think it makes sense. It doesn't, just because we say that cash is not contraband doesn't mean that the state can't retain possession of it. It can through the forfeiture statutes. Cash might be derivative contraband.
But not through 968-20, is what you
said. Not through the contraband statute. That's correct.
When you say the contraband statute, are you referring to 968.20? What statute are you referring to?
The definition of contraband is in 968.13.
Yes, I have that. That includes forged money, but doesn't
legal cash. That's correct. The 3 points that I had hoped to address here today in oral argument were the necessity of a timely and proper forfeiture hearing, and then more thoroughly, this definition of contraband and why money can't be part of it, and then the absurd results wrought by the state's definition of the term contraband. So on the first issue, the necessity of a forfeiture hearing, the Rosen Court held that a trial court's failure to hold a timely forfeiture hearing deprives it of subject matter jurisdiction over forfeiture of the property. So that means that if the state fails to initiate a hearing within 30 days, or if the trial court fails to conduct a hearing, a forfeiture hearing, within 60 days after the answer is due, then the trial court doesn't have the jurisdiction to order forfeiture of the property.
Ms. Ball, isn't the situation a little bit different here given the fact that this whole matter comes before the trial court based on your client's motion? He brought a motion. He asked for the return of the property. And because of that, the court used 968.20. What's wrong with that? Why shouldn't the court have used 968.20? Your client brought the motion. Your client asked for the return of property. 968.20 says the proper vehicle to get the property back is to bring a motion, consistent with 968.20.
Leonard Jones brought a motion under Chapter 961. There is a return of property provision in Chapter 961 that is identical, almost virtually identical, except for the word contraband in it, under 968.20. There was never any reason for the trial court to move over to that 968.20 statute.
Well, didn't the state direct the court's attention to 968.20?
The state did, but Leonard Jones did not come into this hearing prepared to argue that his money was was not contraband.
Came into the hearing asking that he get his money back. Don't you think it would be reasonable to anticipate that he might run into an issue of contraband?
Not necessarily, because in this instance he has Rosen on his side, and that says that if the state fails to initiate that forfeiture proceeding, then the defendant is allowed to get his money back, or the property, whatever it may be. That was the basis for his motion. I don't know that he was thinking...
In Rosen, was there any reference to 968-20? Was there any discussion of 968-20?
No. And, Your Honor, just to sort of help understand these return of property statutes, you have a provision for return of property in Chapter 961, mm-hmm. and it mirrors the one in 968.20, and that mirrors another one in 973. So there's three of them out there, which suggest to me that the legislature was trying to provide a means for a person to get their property back, no matter which statute or situation you're operating under. But here, we very specifically know that the state was seizing the property because it suspected the money of being derived through a violation of Chapter 961. And in that case, it seems the most appropriate statute to use is Chapter 961.
Well, what difference does it make which one they use? I mean, you say that they all look alike substantially. What difference does it make?
It makes a difference because if you follow the statute through, under Chapter 961, if money is forfeited, then the trial court has the authority to order that money deposited into the school fund, for example. But if you're under Chapter 968.20 and you follow the examples of property and where it can go, there isn't a provision in there for how to return money. That's one reason it makes a difference. And the second reason is Chapter 968.20 doesn't include these same timing requirements that Chapter 961 does for the forfeiture proceeding. 968.20 is a return of property statute only, not a forfeiture one. And 961.55 includes these procedural due process safeguards that were circumvented in this instance and can be any time the court decides to move under 968.20.
Under 968.20, what does the court say? No, we're not going to return the property? Is that the end result of that?
In this instance?
No, in a 968.20. The court can say I'll return it or I won't return it, right?
True.
And what happens with the property if the court says I won't return it?
If you follow down farther in the statute, it gives examples of how it could be taken care of, like in firearm situations or dangerous property, destroy it, etc.
Why did the legislature enact 961 given the presence of 968?
That is a very good question, Your Honor. And it's possible that when they revised these statutes, 961 and 973, that they weren't necessarily taking into consideration that there would be potentially overlap for 968.20. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. Here, if we say that if the state is going to seize property connected to a drug crime and it has to use the forfeiture proceedings in the Uniform Controlled Substances Act and obtain forfeiture there, or the person seeking return of the property has to use that provision, you save 968.20 for cases that don't have anything to do with drug trafficking.
Do we make a nullity, in essence, and I'm going to ask Mr. Farmer this also, if we should hold for the state in this instance, do we make a nullity of 961? Is any prosecutor going to proceed under anything other than 968? Is there any reason to proceed under 961?
Well, I think it certainly provides the state an incentive to go after, to prefer to use 968.20, because 961 has these specific provisions for the hearing and the timing requirements. And if the state prefers to not initiate those forfeiture proceedings, it hangs on to the property until, at some point, maybe after the case is over, the defendant or the owner of the property, not necessarily a defendant, moves for return of the property.
Ms. Ball, let me ask you, don't you think that one of your strongest arguments here is related to the determination made by the trial judge that your client had the burden of proof?
That certainly is a very large problem with what happened in this case.
Well, I haven't heard you mention it. That's why I'm asking.
Thank you.
Do you not think that's significant?
I think it's very significant. In this case, the trial court told Leonard Jones that he had the burden to prove that this money was not contraband. But that statement was made or based upon an incorrect reading of the case State v. Welcher. Right now, both Mr. Farmer and I agree that Welcher doesn't say that. It doesn't put the burden of proof on the property owner to prove that his money is legitimate. The appropriate burden of proof at the trial court stage should have been, did the state prove to a reasonable degree of certainty by the greater weight of the evidence that Leonard Jones's money was derived through a violation of the Uniform
Control Services? Now, the state takes the position that it doesn't really make any difference here, that the judge would have come to the same conclusion that this was contraband, whether or not the burden was on the state rather than on your client. Do you agree with that?
No, I disagree for two reasons. First, it makes a big difference from this procedural safeguard point of view. If you're going to go strictly under 968.20, there's no timing requirements. So you can sidestep those due process procedural safeguards discussed in Rosen. And the second reason it makes a difference is if you imposed this burden of proof, the Chapter 961 burden of proof on the state in the 968.20 hearing, I think that the state would have lost if it was held to that standard of proof. And here's why. If you look at the evidence presented at the trial court and take it as being true, even though I suspect Leonard Jones contested it, but if you take that as being true, what did the state find? It didn't find drugs, for example. It didn't find any traces of drugs, and there was no testimony any police officer or anyone had witnessed a drug transaction here. Instead, what the state found was some blackened chore boy pot scrubbers, a scale in a car that was borrowed, cigarette lighters, and money neatly packaged in a certain way that was comprised mostly of $20 bills and all turned the same direction. The state says that's enough to prove that money, the specific money on Leonard Jones, was derived through a drug sale. But while there isn't a Wisconsin case that really describes what that level of proof is for what's the connection between drugs and money, there were a number of other cases from around the country that talk about that connection. We describe some of them in our brief. I think it's around pages 23 to 25. And they hold, for example, that the mere existence of a large sum of money, or the way it's stored, or even if it's packaged as a drug dealer would package that property, doesn't prove that the money came from the sale of drugs. They also hold that money that is found close to drugs or close to drug paraphernalia is also not enough evidence to establish that it came through the sale of drugs.
As an aside, and I've got to ask it, and it shows my naivete and that I've not been in the trenches for a long time, what does chore boys have to do with drug paraphernalia?
Well, I can only repeat what I read in the record. I didn't represent that I'm alone. I have no personal experience with this. But a chore boy pot scrubber apparently is a mesh scrubber that you can pull apart and somehow put into a pipe and inhale substances through it, I guess in the same way that you may need a screen or something like that for other kinds of inhalation of drugs.
So I better not buy any char boys.
Well, they're available.
Counsel, you asserted earlier that the motion here was brought pursuant to 961, I suppose, point 55. I'm looking through the record, and there's no written motion.
Your Honor, we supplemented the record. We filed a motion. It was granted, and it's included in the appendix to our brief.
Was the defendant representing himself?
Yes, he was pro se, Your Honor, both at the trial court level and at the Court of Appeals. Another point that I would like to address here is the scope of the contraband statute and why we believe that money can never be contraband. The framework of the statute of Section 968.13 suggests that the term contraband means items of property that are illegal to possess, and that it doesn't extend to this notion of derivative contraband or the fruits or instruments of a crime. So if you look at section 968.13, sub 1, sub A, it discusses contraband, and it gives examples of items of property that citizens may never possess, like a controlled substance, for example. And then subsection 1B refers to instruments or fruit of a crime. Money falls very clearly under subsection 1B. This court's decision in State v. Beauchart provides further support for that narrow definition, because in the Beauchart case, the court held that it is the inherent nature of property, not the use to which it has been put, which makes it subject to confiscation of as contraband. Money is not inherently illegal. Only its use could ever subject it to forfeiture. Now, the state asked the court to examine the legislative history of sections 968.20 and 968.13. This really is not necessary, but if the court wishes to accept that invitation, it will find that the history supports the contention that money is not contraband.
I'm having trouble understanding the distinction you're making. You're saying money can never be contraband, and then in another phrase or two earlier, you are talking about the fact it can be derivative contraband. What's the difference? If it's derivative contraband rather than contraband straight out, still contraband, isn't it?
No, I think that section 968.13, if you use this a justum generis analysis that we have in there, you look for the characteristic that's the same among the examples listed there. There are things that are per se illegal to possess. That means no person here has a right to possess the controlled substance or counterfeit money. And you can only possess certain other things if you've got the approval from the state. It's not something that any person on their own could use. Money or derivative contraband gets into this: how was it used, or how was it derived, basically. And I think that the statute is specifically drawing a distinction between those, because the fruit or instruments of a crime provision in subsection B sounds just like derivative contraband.
Well, doesn't the statute also say that the enumeration listed in A is not exhaustive? In other words, that's not all that's contraband?
That's true, and I think that's a fair statement, but when you're interpreting that including without limitations clause, that's where we perform the analysis to look at the examples of property within that subsection, and you say contraband can include things that are like those that are in there, and the characteristic they all have in common is that no one has a right to possess them.
What about a bank robber who's got a bag full of money? Is that contraband?
It may be derivative contraband, the fruit or instrument of a crime, but no, it is not under 968.13.
And what is it? Sub 1, sub A.
Right, I'm sorry, yes.
What is the state claiming here? Is it claiming that this money is a sub 1A or sub 1B?
Sub 1A.
They've never made the argument that it's sub 1B.
They're saying that sub 1A, that term contraband, includes the notion of derivative contraband, and it includes money. This leads to, I guess, another point that I'd like to make about the contraband statute, and that's these absurd results that happen when you define the term too broadly. Examples of them are that the broad definition allows the state to bypass the forfeiture statutes and their procedural safeguards. We've discussed that. The next example is that if contraband under 968.13(1A) includes fruits or instruments of a crime, then why have 1B, the fruit or instruments of a crime provision? And the third point is that a broad definition of contraband jeopardizes the rights of innocent persons. 968.20 says that property other than contraband can be returned to its owner, but if contraband includes innocent property put to illegal use, the innocent property owner who has not consented to its illegal use loses his or her right to get the property back.
Why isn't this a fruit of the crime, then?
The money? It would fall under the concept of a fruit of
a search warrant, right?
Under B. Well, their search warrants aren't really an issue here, but
I know.
In that distinction, yes. I would also like to address one of the arguments that the state made in its brief, and that is this concept that if the court requires the state to force, requires the state to initiate a forfeiture proceeding for every trivial piece of property that it might seize, that this would result in a chilling inundation of the courts. That doesn't necessarily need to occur here. If the state prefers not to initiate a forfeiture proceeding, it doesn't have to. But then when the property owner asks to get the property back, the state has to give it back to him. So if it's inconvenient to file forfeiture actions for ski masks or baggies, the state needn't bother. But when the state wants permanent possession of a piece of property that's inherently innocent, like money or a car, it must comply with the forfeiture statutes.
I need to have something cleared up. If the state had proceeded under 968.13 sub 1 sub B, would we be here today?
That doesn't solve the problem here. What they needed to do was proceed under a forfeiture statute, not a return of property statute.
But you do concede that this could come under sub B.
It falls within the definition of fruit or instrument of a crime. It's just that the reason that they... Short answer is yes, Your Honor.
Well, the problem I'm having, and I think it's the same that Justice Babbage is having, okay, so you fall under 968.13.1b, which authorizes a search warrant for money.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, so they got the money. Your position is you don't come under 960, your client doesn't come under 968.20. Why not? Just precisely, why not?
Partly procedurally, because the motion was 961, and also because if you define that term contraband narrowly to mean property inherently illegal to possess, the state can't retain it.
Okay. And so under 968.20, you're going to be defining contraband narrowly,
correct,
not to include 1B, that is a fruit of a crime.
That's right.
Okay.
If I may follow up, under 968.20, it doesn't necessarily have to be seized by a search warrant. It can be seized, as it was in this case, without a search warrant.
That is correct.
And right, and it says any person claiming the right to possession of property, as clearly as property, and it does, you have conceded, fall under 968.13 sub 1 sub B.
That is right. The problem here is that 968.20 isn't a forfeiture statute. In order for the state to obtain it, it had to start the forfeiture proceedings earlier, under 961.55. So really what's happening here is getting around that opportunity, the very limited opportunity, the 30-day, 60-day timing, to prove that something that isn't inherently illegal is, after all, illegal. It's contraband.
So, let me just follow. So if they don't follow the first statute, which you're referring to under 961.55, and later on there's a motion by the defendant, say, to get the property back, what are you saying, that they cannot use that? Is that what you're saying? Because they failed to do it in the first place?
If the state fails to initiate a forfeiture action and then later the defendant moves to get the property back, the state, the court should order the property returned as long as it is not contraband. And when I say contraband, I mean the very narrow definition of something inherently illegal to possess.
Does that make sense?
To me, yes, it does.
Because you're saying that absolutely they have to proceed under 961, and they have waived that opportunity. In other words, they have forfeited their right to fail to go under that one statute.
That's right. They've forfeited, or they've gone past the opportunity to prove the connection between innocent property and how it was used or how it was derived. The only remaining question, the only remaining way the state could keep it is if it was somehow inherently illegal to possess.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Farmer, Assistant District Attorney of Dane County, representing the state.
May it please the court. My name is Ken Farmer, and I'm an Assistant District Attorney from Dane County, and I represent the respondent state of Wisconsin. In this case, petitioner moved the trial court for the return of $1,783 in drug money found in his person when he was searched incident to a lawful arrest. The trial court correctly applied 968.20 of the Wisconsin statutes in response to this motion.
Excuse me for interrupting so early, but did he file, Ms. Ball said that she filed under 960.
He filed a motion for return of property. He cited 961 within that motion.
He did not say 960.
He did not mention 968.20. But he made that motion in the trial court then, used 968.20 because it was property being held in evidence, which is what that statute is for. The trial court we had a hearing, and it was determined that it, in fact, was contraband, this property. The trial court concluded it was contraband because contraband includes what is used in the commission or was the result of the commission of a crime. It determined that the drug money was, in fact, contraband to the extent it was used in the commission of or was the result of the crime of drug trafficking. It therefore barred its return under 968.20. The Court of Appeals affirmed that decision. The state's position here is that contraband includes not only what is by its nature illegal, but also what has been used in or is the result of the commission of a crime, whether or not it is innocent itself. 968.13 defines contraband by first starting off with the phrase, contraband includes without limitation because of enumeration, and then gives a series of examples of contraband. 968.13 gives as one of those examples forged money or written instruments, and significantly, the tools, dies, machines, or materials for making them. That is for making forged instruments or forged money. Now, the tools, dies, machines, and materials for making forged money or forged written instruments could include a copy machine used to copy ordinary money to pass off somewhere. It could include a printing press that might be used to otherwise make wedding invitations or a business card. It could include paper or ink or any number of things which are not inherently illegal to possess. Yet such items are contraband since they are used in the commission of a crime.
Is that the section, Mr. Farmer, that you're relying on within sub A, forged money or written instruments and the tools, dies, machines, or materials for making them?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. You don't rely on any other part of the definitional components found in subsection A?
Well, there are a number of other items that are listed in there that currently are not illegal to possess in and of themselves, but may have been at the time of the inception of the statute.
But in this case, the cash, you...
Right. I primarily rely upon that specific language.
Why would you rely on that? It's not a forged instrument.
Well,
it's not a forged money or written instrument. It means
sure.
Forged. It's not tools, dies, machines, or materials. It seems to me you should be relying on includes without limitation.
Well, I'm relying on both of those, Your Honor. As counsel for the petitioner indicated, because it says includes without limitation because of enumeration, we have to go in things that are to things that are not listed there that might be analogous to what's listed. And I'm saying cash is analogous to the tools, dies, machines, and materials for making forged instruments to the extent those are instrumentalities of crime, and cash is the instrumentality of drug trafficking, which is a crime.
So if somebody was charged with gambling, or with if there was a crime that relates to security laws or fraudulent retention of funds, embezzlement, then you can take their whole bank account. And then after the charge is dismissed, you can keep the money.
If that occurs and there's no forfeiture action being pursued, all right, what I'm submitting is if somebody up in that situation, that stuff is being held, money or some
right.
proceeds thereof is being held in evidence,
right.
that the proper statute is 968.20. And if they move for its return, the trial court's correct in applying that statute to determine if it should be returned. And if it applies in that situation, it does, yes.
You return the money under the circumstances I just gave you? Why are you returning money if this is
No, I would not return
fraud.
Money in the circumstances. If the circumstances that you gave me include that the trial court, that the defendant in that case applied for the return of the property, which was held in evidence, and the court determined that that was contraband, that was used in the commission of a crime, then my answer is yes, that would not be returned under those circumstances.
Counsel, one view, and it's your opponent's view of this case, is, look, the motion was filed under 961, states it in the motion. The state blew the time limit. 961 has in it specifically reference to money. And that in order to go under 968.21a, there's a certain convolution that you have to say, okay, money isn't specifically mentioned as it is in 961, but we can liken it, money, to a photocopy machine that makes forged money as a tool for the commission of crime. It seems awfully convoluted.
I think it comes from an interpretation of the contraband the term contraband. You can't, when you define contraband, list every possible thing that could be contraband. What the legislature then did was they said it includes without limitation because of enumeration. And then it listed the examples. That's why the statute has to read that way. And I think then what you have to do is apply that statute. Now, it may be convoluted, as you say, when you do it, but I don't think that it is a difficult or strained interpretation at all.
If you had to do it over again, you just comply with the time limits, use money as defined in 961 and do it that way, and not be put in a position to be making these...
That's an option we have, all right? But what I'm saying here is if you take their interpretation, which is to say that contraband only includes what is per se illegal, which forces us to file a forfeiture action every single time. You have something which is innocent in and of itself, but which is an instrumentality of crime, then we will be forced to file hundreds of lawsuits every time we do a search warrant to keep that property from being returned. And we're not just talking here as far as a policy matter with respect to just cash. We're talking about any instrumentality of the drug trade, a beeper, chore boy, a scale, an electronic organizer, or, you know, used to keep customer lists, any number of those things.
A telephone.
A cell phone, for example, is frequently used. And what I'm saying is it's important not to have those items returned to the drug trafficker so that they can be used in drug trafficking again. And I submit that 968.20 enables us to keep those things out of the drug trafficker's hands.
Let me just ask you this. Why? Sorry. But you've got a special statute that deals with control of substances. I mean, it runs a full page, more than a full page in the statute books. It tells you how to do it, when to do it, covers money. You've got all the power, I assume, you need under 961. Why are we then going to? Why are you relying on 968? It would seem to me that the special statute that relates to drugs is the controlling statute.
Your Honor.
And I didn't even look up the dates, it may be that's the newer one, too. Go ahead.
My point here is that it depends on the procedural posture in which the thing comes to the court. If you have something which is in the custody of the police, which incidentally 961.55 can deal with property which is not even in the custody of the police, all right? If you have that and it's in evidence and somebody says, hey, I want it back, then the proper statute is 968.20. I mean, it's not a matter of, well, 961.55 has all these procedures. It's a matter of which statute you use given the procedural posture of the case. And in this case, the procedural posture was to ask for property back, which is being held in evidence.
Yeah, but the point then is the state doesn't have to do anything. Under 961.555, the state would ordinarily have to commence a proceeding in 30 days to get the property back. So this is a protection for the people whose property has been seized. So you can sit back then and let the 30 days ride. Now 2 years have passed. The case has been heard. It's been dismissed. I'm making this up, but let's assume that. And so now defendant comes and says, hey, how do I get this back? Won't you please give it to me? And the state says, no, because we think it's contraband. And you're forcing the defendant, especially one who has been dismissed, to come in and sue you rather than you take the appropriate procedures under 961.55. That's what you're really asking, isn't it?
I am asking that 968, when a person applies for a return of property, and that may occur in that instance, I grant that, all right? What I'm saying is that 968.20 is the proper vehicle under the circumstances that were in this case to apply for the return.
Why would a district attorney, and I was one for 4 years, why would a district attorney ever proceed under 961.55 when you've got 968.20 available to you?
Number of reasons. One, as I indicated earlier, 961.55 deals with items which are seized by the police as well as that which is maybe in the possession of a third party or commingled or you don't even know where it is or another jurisdiction. So the prosecutor would use it in those instances. The prosecutor would also use it in a way as far as getting the ball rolling more quickly. You know, we talk about time limits as if the time limits are something that always work against the state. More often than not, in the forfeiture actions that I've seen under the drug forfeiture statute, the time limits work for the prosecution to the extent that defendants frequently will default when it comes to responding. In other words,
so 961.55 is a frequently utilized statute.
I don't know. It is used often enough. And I personally use it on numerous occasions myself. I can't speak for other people and other prosecutors, but it is used.
Do the trial judges welcome forfeiture actions along with their normal calendar? Milwaukee would need a separate forfeiture court.
That's my point, Your Honor. My point is, it is a better policy system. It is a better policy system to allow the prosecutor to choose which actions he wants to follow for, cases he wants to follow forfeiture action on, but not force him in every little case involving every conceivable instrumentality of drug trafficking to file a forfeiture action. You know, we're faced with a dilemma there. The policy system I propose, the state proposes, avoids that dilemma.
Well, maybe we better go to the legislature and let the legislature avoid the dilemma.
Well,
my question, just to follow up with
the chief. What's your answer to that?
The legislature, I believe, has answered the question in this case by having 968.20. If the answer is, or the question says, well, maybe the legislature should give us more resources or something like that in order to file forfeiture actions, perhaps that is a solution. But I think the legislature is indicated by the broad language that's in 968.13 and 968.20, the proper remedy, and that was what was applied here.
My question would be, and this is the follow-up, that is there something fundamentally wrong, unfair, about having these two processes being the statute 961.55 and 968.20, other than, they feel it's that's my question about being able to operate.
There is not anything fundamentally unfair about it. It was not anything fundamentally unfair in this case, Your Honor. In 968.20, there is a due process hearing that exists. All right? The only difference, perhaps, is time limits. In this particular case, Mr. Jones had the right to face his witnesses. He had the right to call witnesses. He had the right to cross-examine witnesses and did. He had a neutral judge decide his case. In other words, there's no unfairness which
was engendered in this particular case, nor in the interpretation that I offered you.
Mr. Farmer, in this particular case, however, it's my understanding you now concede that the burden in regard to whether or not the property was contraband was on the state.
Right.
What is that burden? How would you express that burden?
Well, I think that actually the burden is not stated in the case law one way or another. If the burden is upon the state to show it as contraband, I think perhaps, as I indicated in my brief, it can be the same as what would be under 961.55, which is to a reasonable degree of certainty standard with a greater weight of credible evidence.
So it would be the civil burden.
Right.
The lowest of the civil.
Right. And as the court, as Justice Crooks indicated earlier, or questioned earlier, or pointed out earlier, the trial court, even though it applied, placed the burden of proof erroneously on the defendant, I believe that would be harmless error in this particular case, because the evidence was uncontroverted that this was drug money. If the burden had been on the state in the case, the same result would have occurred. There would have been a fine, and if that burden of a reasonable degree of certainty had been applied, the same result would have occurred.
Now, counsel, why didn't you make the claim that this is derivative contraband under sub 1 sub B, 968.13 sub 1 sub B, and that you have the exact same right to it and under 968.20 and under, you know,
right.
That you still need? Why don't you make that argument?
Because, well, we went to the contraband statute, which is 968.20. It says contraband shall not be returned. It used that specific word.
Right, but it also says that any other property shall be returned if the property is not needed as evidence. Can't you make
right,
the argument that you need
sure.
it as evidence?
I think there's certainly room to argue that in that case, and I think the same result obviously would occur, which is not to return this money under that particular analysis. But I think the
stronger argument... if you miss the argument, that's okay, too. You know, we all miss things.
Sure, sure. And if that's certainly an argument that can be made.
Is it needed as evidence if the case is dismissed? I'm finding
Actually, procedurally, what happened in this case was we held the hearing, and then it was dismissed. So at that time, it was needed as evidence.
But after it's dismissed, if you're holding something for evidence and the case is dismissed, what do you generally do with it?
If a case it depends upon if someone asks for it back. If someone doesn't ask for the evidence back, then what occurs is it effectively becomes abandoned at a certain point. And abandoned property statutes, there are several that are potentially applicable, are used. If, on the other hand, if they ask for it back, then I think that it's not abandoned at that point, and then the question is it a forfeiture? I think the Wisconsin Constitution provides anything that is forfeited, monies are forfeited, have to go to the school fund, which is what the trial court did in this case. One of the points that's made by counsel in this particular thing is that this case is that somehow or another, our interpretation doesn't protect the rights of innocent property owners. And I suggest to you that Mr. Jones, and this is a connection with this whole dismissal idea, was not an innocent property owner. Mr. Jones was found by the trial court, even though the charge was dismissed, by the way, not on the merits, to be in possession of the scale, to be in possession of the chore boy, to be in possession of drug paraphernalia used in trafficking in controlled substances. So if we're going to talk about the innocent person, he is not before this court today. Besides that, I suggest that 968...
Of course, we have to be concerned about the innocent person.
Sure, sure. But what I'm saying is that if... My next point is, if he were before the court today, that 968.20, I believe, inherent in that is the discretion of the trial court to return that property to an innocent owner.
Well, even if it's the material was taken here, suppose his wife owned this property. I don't see why the police should have to give that back if it's contraband material, if it's connected to the commission of a crime.
That's my point.
You could set up her in business.
Well, you know, that's my point. I mean, the question is it used in the commission of a crime? And that's what 968.13 gives an example of, and I think that's what's appropriate here to apply.
Why don't you take all of his bank accounts? You didn't find drugs on them. You found drug paraphernalia. Was there drugs on the bills? You can test bills for drugs.
No.
It doesn't mean it was his drugs, but you can test bills. Was there any drug?
No.
Okay.
But
so what difference is, why does it matter that it was on his person or in the car? Why don't you take the $5 million that he's got in the bank? Or the $10 million he's got in treasury?
Because, okay, that money, you can't connect to drug trafficking the way you can. You talk about some ways you could connect it. Well, in this particular instance, we connected it otherwise because of the number of 20s, for example, that were in there, which is a most common crack transaction. The number of the fact that there was a scale in the car.
That's right. I give you the scale, and I give you the paraphernalia. But suppose he's got in the house $20,000 in $20 bills. He collects them, new and old. He thinks the old ones are going to, that's what he says, the old ones are going to go up in value as collector items. Anyway.
Don't the federal courts make that determination?
Yes, that's what I was going to respond to.
They're confiscating cars, houses, money, if it's connected with a crime.
That's the posture in which it comes before this court. The clearly erroneous rule applies here. We don't sit here de novo and try to second guess the trial court. The trial court made a finding, which is upheld unless it is clearly erroneous, that this was drug money, that this was an instrumentality of crime. And we can come up with hypotheticals all day, and it doesn't matter because we are not sitting here as a de novo court.
Justice Prosser has a question.
Sure. At the time that Judge Ollock held the hearing, was there a pending paraphernalia charge?
Yes.
Did Mr. Jones testify at that hearing?
He did not testify at the hearing on the motion to refuse. He was offered the opportunity to, and he declined.
And you were present.
Yes, I was.
If Mr. Jones had testified, would you have asked him any questions about where he got the money? And
absolutely. In that regard, I think what you're getting at is perhaps is there a Fifth Amendment problem with him in that situation, the way they came up. In that regard, the case law is for us like for suppression hearings. This was a suppression hearing at the same time, by the way. You cannot use against an individual statements he makes at a suppression hearing except for impeachment purposes. So I could question him all day, and I don't think I could necessarily, because it was a suppression hearing at the same time, use it against him at the trial later.
Unless he says he didn't do it. Then you can impeach him.
Right. It depends. For impeachment under Simmons, I think you could do that.
Could I ask one? In 968.13.1, the word contraband, what does that mean?
The definition, it uses contraband, it says contraband, then it gives a bunch of examples to illustrate what it means. That's how it defines it. It doesn't use an abstract phrase to define contraband. It simply gives a series of examples, and of course one of those examples is what I submit is clearly and it's not, you know, innocent to possess, but which becomes contraband by virtue of its use in a criminal enterprise. So it doesn't give an abstract phrase. It just lists a number of examples, and it says we're not limited to those examples.
Well, I have possessed lottery tickets. I mean, that's not, I mean, it might be a different kind of lottery ticket.
Right. Part of the problem with lottery tickets is that when the statute was adopted in 1970, when lottery tickets were illegal to possess, so I'm not sure if that's a good example.
Well, dyes, picture films.
Yep.
I mean, there's some legal things in here. Didn't you talk about the possibility of a printing press or a Xerox machine, copy machine? What is contraband?
Contraband includes what is on the list there, as well as what is analogous to the items on the list. And what is like, what is the tools and dyes and so forth that is in there, is instrumentalities of crime. And cash, drug money, which was found by the trial court, is in fact an instrumentality of crime. I mean, just as if the tools and dyes and machines are an instrumentality of the crime of counterfeiting or the crime of forgery, drug money
is an instrumentality of the crime of delivery of controlled substances.
But shouldn't the state have to establish that the thing being held was an instrumentality of crime?
It did. And I believe we did in this case.
We did, and
the trial court held that, and it's to be upheld unless clearly erroneous. We established that by showing, we presented expert testimony from an officer experienced in that area. He looked at the totality of the facts, how the stuff was packaged. It was packaged like it was a cash register, and neatly folded in different parts of his body. Those are things that drug dealers do when they keep, the number of 20s, the scale. And the fact that the defendant offered no reasonable explanation. When the defendant was asked by the officer, well, why do you have all this? He said, none of your business. It was the totality of that that established in the trial court that this, in fact, was drug money.
The thing that troubles me a little bit here is that the state can seek the forfeiture of automobiles. And from what you say in terms of contraband, it could seek the forfeiture, or it could obtain possession of printing presses, Xerox machines, telephones, all kinds of things. And yet, to get those things back, the defendant is going to have to come forward, in a sense, and explain it. Because you can put on witnesses who will talk about the probabilities and make your case.
We can put on witnesses, and we would have a burden of showing that, though, Your Honor, at a due process hearing. We would have, and the defendant would have absolutely the full panoply of due process rights in challenging that. That's what I'm saying, and that's what happened here.
The best way to challenge it is for the defendant, or the person whose property has been seized, to go and testify himself or herself.
That's right.
And it seems to me, with all due respect, you would put that person in jeopardy, either of swearing falsely or providing all kinds of leads.
Well, as I indicated earlier, I don't think that information could necessarily be used against him in a subsequent trial on the underlying charge. Because it would be analogous, it's perfectly analogous in this case to the situation in Simmons where you're not allowed to use that against an individual in your case in chief. So there would be, I don't think there would be a problem in that regard. I recognize what you're saying. Sometimes defendants are in a hearing are required to make choices. And I don't believe that choice, though, would be necessarily harmful to the defendant to the extent that would be, I think, interpreted in that way.
Mr. Farber, you were indicating on a couple of occasions that the person seeking the return of property under either statute is entitled to a full panoply of due process rights. What is your legal authority for that?
Well,
are there cases that have
come? I think I cited my brief, State versus Nordness.
Nordness?
Okay. Yes. I think at a minimum, due process requires the notice of a hearing and a hearing, and he was giving these things. He knew what this hearing would be about, and it was concerned whether he'd get his money back, and he had the opportunity to bring in people, and that was his.
But would the burden be on the state?
In 968.20, I would submit that the burden should be on the state to establish that it is contraband, as opposed to whether it's, and that's what Welter dealt with. Welter said the burden is on the state when it comes, or the burden is on the defendant or the property owner when it comes to whether it's needed in evidence anymore. Accordingly, the state's position here is that the $1,783, which was found to be used in or result of the commission of the crime of drug trafficking, should not be returned. And the state submits that the decision of the Court of Appeals and that the decision of the trial court in this matter should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Baum?
Thank you.
proceed. The first matter that I would like to address is this question of why not Section 968.20 under these circumstances. And a response that the court needs to keep in mind is something that the state even argued in its brief, and that is that the state cannot initiate the hearing under 968.20. That's something that only the property owner can do. So 968.20 isn't a forfeiture statute, and it's not designed to be a way for the state to be able to retain property once it's been seized. In addition...
And isn't that a way of... seized, isn't it a way of keeping property that has been seized? At least a judge will determine that.
If the property is contraband, but the real way to keep property that has been seized is through the forfeiture statute. And I think that the Rosen case really fleshes out this issue. What the Rosen case says is, and this addresses a concern of attorney farmers, we don't want to return, for example, and this is the hypothetical, this isn't Rosen, we don't want to return baggies, we don't want to return cell phones and things that will allow someone to go back to drug trafficking. And Rosen says that interest in deterring drug trafficking is taken into consideration with the initial seizure of the property. Now, the next question is, how do you balance that state's interest against a property's owner's right to pursue or to possess property? And the answer, according to Rosen, is that you interpret the forfeiture statutes very narrowly. You interpret them narrowly because we're affected.